recording, and this is the Ghost of Canes, Part 6, the last of our series. And tonight, I'm looking at some reasons why I think Keynesian economics is still popular. In other words, it's kind of a carrying on of the theme, but I wanted to put some things together at the end. I've got all the assignments. I still need to, what I'm behind on is getting your little multiple choice tests. I need to put together a few, but I finally got some time. We're in a situation at the end of the term where everything piles up at once. But enough of that. What I want to do tonight is just, in part six, we're going to go over some reasons why it is that despite, frankly, being really bad econ, and it's bad econ, there's just no doubt about it, you know, fallacies, why is it that Keynesian economics does seem to do well? What can we do about it? All right, what can we, as Austrians, and frankly, as economists that actually believe in, well, econ, you know, the laws of economics, you know, scarcity, opportunity costs, you know, those things that, you know, that once upon a time, the ancients once thought to be part of the econ lexicon. Well, yeah, what do we do about that? All right. So that's, now tonight's lesson will be a little bit shorter. I'm not going to keep you all the way along. Now, again, I would urge you to ask questions, anything that you have, any comments, anything that you need. I would really, that you want to do, go ahead and feel free to ask, all right? First of all, I'm going to be looking at some of the things that we've covered, okay? We have dealt with this overview of Keynesian thinking. Now, I know that in a certain sense, Keynesian thinking is an oxymoron. Now, if you're doing Keynesian thoughts, you're not thinking. I don't know what it is that you're doing, but it is not thinking, it is something else. It is maybe stream of consciousness. I don't know. But we have looked into that, and I think that we've talked about some of the things that why, you know, why this mishmash of stuff emerged. Certainly, we've looked into the intellectual climate that helped feed reaction to the general theory, and I think that that's important. It's something that's often overlooked because we want to jump right away into the fallacies and jump right away into what we think is the wrongheadedness of the thinking. But here's the problem, that intellectual climate matters. As I said before, had Keynes been saying this stuff in, say, 1860, he would not have been taken seriously. As I said, 1870, 1880, 1890, he wouldn't have been taken seriously. If any of you have ever read Alfred Marshall's book on, you know, the principles of political economy, what you find is it's really a pretty good read. It's, I mean, there are some, I think that Menger is superior, 1871, and I think Mises is definitely superior to Marshall. But nonetheless, Marshall's masterpiece is a very, very good piece of work. And my gosh, it is such an easy read. And I don't, when I mean an easy read, that it flows thinking, it's not at all like general theory. I mean, because general theory is just sort of stream of consciousness, smart assedness. Whereas Marshall's work is very, very systematic. Marshall strongly, even though Marshall's a mathematician and a very good one, he strongly believed that if he could not explain the concept in words itself, in something that the, you know, layperson, the educated layperson could understand, then he had been in error. He was the one who needed to work on what he was doing. He didn't dismiss it as, well, you're just too stupid to understand. Instead, he had his math in the footnotes. He had his graphs in the margins. And he did that on purpose, because what he did not want this thing to do was to turn into a combination of math and graphs, okay? And the very thing that Marshall did not want to have happen is what happened in the 20th century. And if you read a copy now of American Economic Review, what you find is, well, frankly, it sucks. I mean, it just, I mean, you know, I quit the, you know, I ended my membership to the AEA a long time ago because, you know, I mean, why would I want to read AR? There's nothing in it. And it's like, if any of you out there have ever been to the annual conference, the ASSA conference, always held in January in some gargantuan city, what you find is you have a thick program book and no sessions that you want to go to. All right. But, you know, and I think that, you know, unfortunately, that intellectual climate fits much closer to what Keynes was experiencing. So when Keynes wrote in the 1930s, when there was a sense of cynicism, when things weren't working, and so Keynes comes in, and he's, you know, well, everybody says, well, I guess that all the other economists must have been wrong because the economy is in bad shape. And so Keynes is able to take advantage of that. But, and also, we've looked at some of the particulars of Keynesian theory. We've spent some time, for example, on liquidity craps. And I'm really glad we did that because the situation we have right now with the Fed having pushed interest rates down to near zero, and Paul Krugman continues to say we're in a liquidity crap, so therefore the rules are different. And the Austrian will say, no, the rules of economics have not been suspended, that spending does not create demand, borrowing and spending does not create demand, real demand, that Say's law still holds. In other words, that the intellectual, let me put it this way. The intellectual climate being what it was and being what it has become in mainstream economics, something like, you know, Keynes's so-called discrediting of Say's law is taken seriously. In the mid-1800s, that would not have been taken seriously. The first thing they would have said is, you're misrepresenting it. And not only that, but the educated people in economics, or what they would call then political economy, the educated people would have recognized immediately that Keynes was misrepresenting Say's law, and that therefore there would have been no claim of discrediting Say's law because Keynes hadn't addressed it. All right, and then last week we compared the Keynesian theory and the Austrian business cycle theory. All right, and we did, in other words, we looked at that. We really, and what we did was we went into what Krugman has said about it, because Paul Krugman is sort of, I guess, all of, I think Robert Higgs calls him the vulgar Keynesian. Nonetheless, I like what he said. So that I think that at least Krugman does try to represent the Keynesian thinking, and certainly I think his response to the Austrian theory, basically dismissing it as a rant of idiots, and, you know, having as much intellectual prowess as the phlogist in the Theory of Fire, whatever that is. So I think that we have to understand where the differences are. So, all right. So, you know, and it's a question, and this is really a question that we started with in this term, isn't it? Why in the world is Keynesian economics or Keynesianism popular, really, after the 19th century economists essentially discredited it? It's something I think what we have to understand, you know, that that there is this what we call Whig theory of history, and that we continue to boot like that. So it's like, I'm going to be very honest, which is what came out of Chicago school and what I had repeated to me in graduate school at Auburn by people who believed the Chicago school people were right, and that was that in economics, we have constantly made progress, and what has been seen as good is accepted by the scientific community. What is not so good is discarded. And so the latest edition of American Economic Review is the latest in economic thinking. Or, you know, we used to say the latest, whatever Hal Varian is doing with his textbook. All right. And that came out, you know, it's really a rendition of good old Whig theory. Okay. Well, let's think about this for a second. Okay. I would like to say in lots of ways that at least with the academic mainstream, that economics has taken many steps backward. We no longer embrace a view that markets can self-correct, that everything has been so mathematicized to a point where it's almost meaningless, and that the math itself becomes the important thing. If you're doing math, then you're doing economics. Whereas the economics itself is pushed aside. And not only that, I would say academic economics is going to be in a lot of trouble. Why? Well, right now, maybe 40% of economic PhDs each year are granted to Americans, people, you know, who actually are from this country. 60% are from people from outside the country who come to graduate school in the United States. Now, that in itself is not a bad thing. I'm not saying, you know, this is not, oh my gosh, the immigrants are coming. But here is the thing, that most of them coming in do so with math background. Very strong math backgrounds. And so the curriculi for academic economics graduate program is very much aimed at these students and presenting a curriculum that is very, very mathematical in orientation. All right. And one of the things that happens is these folks can do all sorts of math models, but they cannot explain opportunity cost. I've got a friend, Doug McKenzie, got his doctorate at George Mason, and I forget where he is now. I think he's somewhere out. He's out west. And Doug was, he's from New Jersey. He was looking at Rutgers, and he was talking to somebody who was just a few weeks away from defending his dissertation. The guy had no idea what opportunity cost was. Now you have to ask yourself, what does that mean? And so again, I'm not really trying to get off the subject so much. I'm saying we've got to understand the intellectual climate. All right. Because let me tell you that the ideas that Keynes espoused were discredited intellectually in the 1800s. They came back again. Why? Because events and also a change in the intellectual climate, which very well tied to the events, made it possible. All right. So what is it that, you know, and I've come up with five reasons, and the rest of the lesson tonight, we're going to look at these five reasons as to why Keynesianism is popular, even after, frankly, being discredited. Now, I didn't call it Keynesianism. But nonetheless, it was the same set of ideas, the underconsumption. And that's really, if you look at it, Keynesianism essentially is underconsumption theory. Marxian theory, they're all tied in together. I mean, there's slight differences here and there. I'm not saying Keynes is a Marxist, but rather what I'm saying is a lot of the things that they agreed upon are there. And they were pretty well discredited. All right, so why is it? Well, number one, Keynesianism really satisfies the worldview of progressive intellectuals and politicians about markets. Now, you're going to see me use the term progressive a lot. And what I'm really speaking of is this so-called progressive movement that made headway in the United States. And it really became the dominant political way of thinking. And it's still there. I mean, people don't call themselves liberals anymore. They call themselves progressives, all right? We have, but also Great Britain, the same sort of thinking, same sort of action that accompanied that thinking became popular among the intelligentsia in Great Britain. And in the United States, the progressive movement was especially virulent, somewhat virulent, racist, very racist. The Jim Crow system that came about was here because of progressivism. It was not a natural residual of America after the Civil War. It actually became part of the progressive movement. And it's what, what I've written about earlier. But it really does satisfy a worldview. Progressives have a worldview of markets, as markets being really bad and or inefficient or brutal. We'll talk about that in a second, a little bit more. Second, it provides a positive set of solutions instead of negative economics solutions. Let's think about this, because we're hearing, what's the talk now? We really shouldn't be speaking of negative liberties and negative freedom. We should be talking about positive freedom. Franklin Roosevelt and the Four Freedoms. The Four Freedoms were what we would call positive freedoms, and we will get into that in a little way. All right, it offers an easy way out of a recession. And this is, Krugman is speaking very much at, hey, all we've got to do is to start spending, people, and borrowing and spending. Keynesianism appeals to the intuition of most people regarding business cycles, but it also appeals to science and mathematics, all right, that we can examine an entire economy through sets of mathematical equations. And they make sense, all right? And last, it makes politicians, central bankers, and intellectuals into heroes. Likewise, people like us, we're not only not heroes, we're bad guys. I mean, we really are bad guys. Read Krugman, if you haven't. I mean, he'll tell you that what we want is for people to starve. We want people to live on the streets, to have to eat dirt, to die for lack of medical care, because that's the way we are. We're just really bad people. And, that they literally dismiss Austrians as bad people. Why? Because we do not believe that the welfare state is going to be good for the economy. That the fact that we do not even believe that the welfare state is a way for people to get out of poverty. And what happens is, of course, if you don't believe that, well, then what you really don't believe is in, helping the poor, right? And so those are the five reasons. We're going to go over those tonight. Okay, any questions before we start with that? I want to, if anybody thinks, for example, that there might be other reasons, and I'm sure there are other reasons, I just think these five reasons are good, and it provided a way for me to organize the lesson. So without further ado, let's begin. All right, progressives and markets, okay. What happened? Remember Pope Francis recently denounced the tyranny of unrestricted markets. Wow. I mean, the tyranny of markets. Think about what this means. If markets are so evil that they're tyrannical, that people are chewed up and spit out in them, and that they're oppressive and they destroy humanity. Now, this is, this isn't some, junior college professor making a statement, whatever, an English perfect. This is the Pope, all right? This is the Pope who is going to be very, very influential. And this clearly is going to it's going to have, it's certainly giving intellectual fodder to people who, you know, to hate markets. By the way, people who hate the Pope, people who hate Catholicism, people who hate religion in general, they can say, look, even the Pope says that markets are bad, so that should be, you know, enough right there, okay? Now, progressives talk about the same way. You know, they talk about unfettered markets and that markets are these unregulated, uncontrolled forces. They're like major, they're storms, and they just blow into an area and they destroy and they leave wreckage in their wake, and people are left destitute. It's also what they say about Walmart. You know, Walmart, very bad thing. This is, you know, I teach in a college of business, and, you know, it, people are surprised you mean you defend Walmart. Even somebody business professors, because they get caught into Walmart, the high cost of low prices, you know, that, and why? Because, people believe that the way out of poverty is for government to force up the prices that owners of factors of production, whether it be labor or raw materials, whatever these owners receive. And in other words, that the view is that if the government can force up business costs, therefore resulting in less production, that will make all of us wealthier. And you scratch your head a little bit and say what? How's that happen? But nonetheless, there's people believe this, all right? I mean, I'm not, you know, I wish they didn't, but they do. But you have to understand, progressives really see markets like this. They see capitalism as this violent force, and it brings change, the kind of turmoil, and it destroys whole ways of living. And, you know, that we don't have the cottage industries in rural England anymore, you know, where people lived and didn't, name their children until they were a year old, because most of them died, within that first year. And somehow that getting rid of that, and then they say, well, if we got rid of that, it's because somehow government intervened, but capitalism would have continued that. I don't know how capitalism would continue, but you know, I'm sure that it would have. That's the way of thinking. In other words, but progressives see markets like this, okay? And Keynesianism definitely. What does it say? It says that markets, if we leave an economy to just these unregulated and tyrannical markets, what are they going to do? They're going to drive the economy down to a point where we have huge amounts of unemployed resources, whether it's unemployed labor, unemployed capital, unemployed raw materials, but that not only that, that markets will lead to this implosion and this horrible, miserable state, that the only way to stop this is for government to intervene. Now, some folks will see some value in markets as long as governments are somehow guiding them. People like to think when they say that Keynes wanted to save capitalism from itself, that's what he meant. All right. Now, you've got to understand that progressivism itself was a intellectual reaction against what we would call 19th century classical liberalism. And that was a worldview that held that individual cooperation was manifested through markets and private institutions, and that state action often hindered cooperation until instead of helping it. Now understand something, that the most peaceful century that Europe has ever had, in my knowledge, was that century from the end of from the Battle of Waterloo, after that was over, the end of the Napoleonic Wars, until 1914, till the Guns of August. And until then, I mean, it's not that you had no wars on the European continent, but they were small, they were very brief, they were localized. This was a time when we speak of classical liberalism, when the economies grew. And I know that, you know, for example, in 1848, you had the various revolutions on the continent. But even to a certain extent, you know, that there you've got people who, you know, hold, and I know that the Marxism took hold in that, and Marx, you know, the Marxist thinking was part of it, but also it, and you had other movements, but nonetheless, we're talking about, think about how it was. You didn't need passports to go from country to country. There was an international gold standard, that standards of living were rising rapidly across the board. I mean, that, yeah, 1914, the vast majority of people were poor, but it was nothing like it had been a century before. If you could compare the century from the standard of living that changed from 1815 to 1914, this in Europe, and compare that from 1715 to 1814, you would not see that much change in that previous century, but a huge amount of change. People were very, very optimistic about the future up until 1914. Sometimes maybe too optimistic, but nonetheless, in the United States especially, progressivism was a reaction against that. It was a reaction against, you know, what men like Jefferson believed about individual liberty and most Americans lived their lives really apart from the state. You know, we forget that because our American history is written through the eyes of modern progressives, and they see the state as paramount. They see the state as the very state is life itself, and so. And certainly, if you read men like Herbert Crowley, The Promise of American Life, Woodrow Wilson, which in 1885 he denounces the Constitution and liberalism. You look at all of the economic reforms. Economic reforms are based upon the belief, supposedly, that individual markets themselves led to monopoly and tyranny and the like. And so you already see progressivism. It really is an intellectual reaction against classical liberalism. And understand this, it's capitalism that was able to build the universities. You know, it's very, very sad that a man like John D. Rockefeller, who was one of the great entrepreneurs in all of history, tremendous entrepreneur, his wealth ends up creating this edifice of anti-capitalism. You know, seen in the University of Chicago, seen frankly in the Riverside Church in New York City, in places like Union Seminary and elsewhere, that Rockefeller himself ultimately embraces progressivism. So many of these so-called captains of industry, which all they were with entrepreneurs and very good ones, they end up unfortunately embracing progressivism itself. But it's, the unfortunate thing is it's the very wealth that capitalism created that allows this intellectual class to flourish. And these are the people that ultimately, you know, their creations, very much those creations of successful capitalism, they end up becoming the worst anti-capitalists. Progressives just did not believe people were capable of voluntary cooperation or that would be useful. They believed that state power needed to be increased. They were very much racial segregationists. If you read, for example, anything that Margaret Sanger wrote, Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, read what she says about black people. I think perhaps one of the most ironic documents I ever read was in 1966, Martin Luther King received the Margaret Sanger Award. And he was not there to receive it, his wife was, but King wrote the speech that she gave. And here is Martin Luther King extolling the greatness of Margaret Sanger, who had actually had said that what they needed to do was through eugenics to eliminate the Negro race. I mean, this is for her view. And so, I mean, it's all beyond me, but if you read the progressives on race, it's pretty bad. And as I pointed out in that paper that I had this earlier this year in Independent Review, the economic, so-called economic reforms and also the reforms like in medicine, they were aimed, many of them directly at blacks and trying to make things worse for them, viewing them as openly as inferior, genetically inferior people who needed to be eliminated through one way or the other through the eugenics process. But you look at also the progressives, they were prohibitionists. Prohibition was in both drug prohibition and also, alcohol prohibition very much were the mainstay of progressivism. And also the military solutions to international conflicts that men like Theodore Roosevelt, they gloried in war. And Woodrow Wilson, who, quote, they want to say the man of peace. I mean, this is a guy who got us in World War One. And these were people that really, this is where progressivism is where you really start seeing the buildup of armed forces and all that. Very, very sad state of affairs. And if you look at that, what did progressives give us? They gave us nationalism. They weren't the ones who gave us patriotism, but they gave us a kind of nationalism that people identified with the governments themselves. Okay. And so to the progressives, the markets were an inferior mechanism for channeling goods and services. And it could be done through socialism or through some sort of interventionism. And then what ultimately happened was a lot of progressives were the ones most loudly and most enthusiastically endorsing the so-called experiment of the Soviet Union. Right. And so out of that, and out of that whole way of thinking, there is no way that people who adhere to that thinking are somehow going to ignore Keynesian criticisms of markets. And they're going to be most likely to believe that, if the government doesn't intervene, that these downturns are going to just implode to where we're in a miserable state of affairs. All right. And so that markets could not be applied to the application of a lot of human needs, and so that we needed more government. All right. And again, that's been, if you want to look at America now that it's become, quote, secular, it's really not. America has a religion, okay? It's called progressivism. And state-sponsored progressivism. That's our religion. I mean, read the New York Times, read all of the, read the paper, conservatives and so-called liberals, both. I mean, that, this is what it's a state religion. It really is. And it's a worship of the state. All right. Let's go to positive versus negative solutions. Now, what do we mean? We get negative liberty. What does negative liberty mean? Okay, the belief was this, that if human beings were not, if the state did not interfere with human beings going through their normal sets of activities, whether trying to make a living, whatnot, that the state did, and I'm not talking about theft or whatnot, because there were institutions and people helped, but I'm talking about through their normal work and producing and meeting the needs of themselves and other people, that what they believed was if the state stayed out of that and did not interfere with them personally, they gave people freedom to live their lives, pursue happiness, that in fact a better society would come from that. Liberties, then, we think of government shall not restrict, pass laws regarding religion, freedom of the press. Government shall not be free just to enter your home as your castle. Government should not be able to simply confiscate your firearms. Government should not be able just to arbitrarily put you on trial. They have to have a case against you, and you, should are to be allowed to defend yourself, and so on and so forth. You know, that the government does not, you know, your papers. Government can't just open your mail and read it. And by the way, this used to be just very much of a, you know, a way of thinking. The old notion that, you know, that years and years ago, and then, you know, that I forget who said it, but Cam, maybe you'll know, that gentlemen do not read other people's mail. And that, I mean, the idea of this kind of government surveillance, which, by the way, really ramped up during World War One. You know, World War One is the first war. You know, I know there's a Civil War, but even more so. I mean, a lot of stuff that Lincoln did was pretty bad during the Civil War, but the point is that World War One really, really becomes open season on dissent. It was Henry Stimson. Yeah, Cam, you're right. Thank you. I appreciate it. Henry Stimson, who was Secretary of State. Whereas, could you imagine John Kerry saying that now? No. Or Hillary Clinton? Hillary Clinton, like, you know, I don't know why she went to read my mail, but apparently she does. But ain't nothing in it. But but what they also believed was that individuals would cooperate with one another. And this goes even back to Adam Smith, and I know, you know, that I know Rothbard really, you know, dumps on Adam Smith. A part of what would Murray do, if Murray got down on somebody, then everything this person said was bad, Murray would really find a way. But if Murray was not down on them, then you know, the person got a little bit better treatment, even if some of the things they said were not very good. That was just, you know, Murray would really zone in on some. But and he, Murray was absolutely right regarding Smith and theory of value and the harm that it did. But nonetheless, the belief was that individuals would acting within their own interests would in fact cooperate with each other and build a better society, that this would happen, whether we talk about the invisible hand of Adam Smith or just the understanding of how markets work, all right, and that people would adjust. And in fact, isn't that what happened throughout? We had recessions in this country, and yet they came out of it without massive government intervention. What made the 1930s different? Nothing. Nothing made them different in terms of what solutions were needed. But you've got to understand that the kind of libertarian or classical liberal philosophy looks at the negative freedoms, negative solutions. What happens if there is a downturn, okay, whatever has caused it, generally, you know, something the government has done, that the government should pull back and say, okay, you know, we're not going to do any more harm. And it's like the Hippocratic Oath, you know, first do no harm. This is, you know, first stop doing further harm. All right. You've got to understand that with modern progressives today and modern intellectuals, negative solutions are seen is bad, or, you know, we're accused of being racist, and while I'm on that subject, let me recommend a book to all of you. David Bernstein, it's called The Last Place of Redress, and he looks at things like the Lochner decision and points out how a lot of free market-oriented decisions in the courts actually benefited blacks. He takes what we would say conventional intellectual wisdom today and turns it upside down. It's marvelous. I used it as a major source in my paper on progressivism and race and economic, the creation of economic rents through regulation. But the point I'm making is that throughout history, that in a libertarian or classical liberal setting that it's believed that people would be able to cooperate. This cooperation would bring us out of a recession, not so that everybody's going to try their best to do this, but through this process that factors of production would be directed away from this wasteful sources and back to the productive or the profitable sources. And that could take place through voluntary exchange and production. No more, right? Yeah, I mean, the idea of negative solution, do nothing. All right, whether it's a negative freedom, the government does not restrict your freedom. Okay, but nowadays it's seen, oh, that's bad. That's, you know, we get accused of all sorts of, the name was called the last place of redress. I believe that's right, the last place of redress. It's in that paper that I have in the Independent Review last June. It's in there, but I'm pretty sure, I think what I remember, the last place of redress. Terrific book. I mean, really, really good, and I highly, highly recommend it. But I wouldn't mind teaching a class off that sometime, because you talk about turning thinking, your thinking, turning the world upside down. That's a really terrific book on that. All right. What's wrong with, you know, so-called negative liberties or, you know, negative solutions? All right. Everything's wrong with it now. I mean, because progress is seen as the expansion of state power. Okay. What happens? There's a problem. The state intervenes and solves it. Intervenes through, you know, direct legislation, through subsidies, through restrictions, maybe arrests, executions, killing people, whatever. And by the way, it's not just a liberal thing. I mean, if you ever read William Crystal, and I try not to read William Crystal, okay? Crystal and David Brooks, my gosh, I can never get through them. Every once in a while, I might read one of Brooks's columns. But well, they've written, both of them, that, you know, basically not, I mean, pulling back is not, you know, or limited government is not a philosophy of governance. In other words, them governing is active. It's energy in the executive. It's the only one place of redress. That's right. Thanks, Cam. We're going to appreciate it. Yes, only one place of redress. That is a terrific book. Just terrific. I strongly recommend it. That's a book that will change your thinking. I say that again. It will change your thinking. All right. But now look at this, okay? It's the conservatives. I mean, everybody. You know, I mean, hey, just sitting around and waiting for something to happen isn't good enough. If you believe that, you want people to starve. You want people, I mean, what about the homeless people right now? What about people out of work right now? Okay? You want praise, you govern, and you do, and you directly involve yourself in something. And so the positive solution, okay, government takes a certain action, might be a financial reform, spending initiatives, guaranteeing of better days to happen, and we're going to make them happen, all right, and doing a combination of all these things. These are positive solutions in the political sphere, and they are solutions. They're positive. They move us in a, quote, positive direction. All right. And so I think, again, what we have to understand, only what we need to understand, is that the modern thinking, modern political thinking, modern intellect is very much statist in its orientation. Okay, and that those of us who do hold to, you know, the Austrian ideas and the libertarian ideas, we're speaking a very different language. There's a reason these folks hate our guts. You know, we don't speak the language that they do, but not only that, what we're saying to them is that you can't fix it through force. You can't fix it by showering dollars on top of something. And they don't want to hear that. Okay? But Keynesianism appeals to that kind of thinking, does it not? The general theory is in itself, this is an interventionist book. It says that intervention not only works, it will work, and that a lack of intergovernment intervention is going to be disastrous. Now, by the way, Keynes doesn't explain why this implosion, why it failed to happen before, why didn't it happen in 1921. If you notice that, by the way, you don't have to worry about causality any longer. You don't even have, for all the talk about science and empiricism and whatnot, nonetheless, that if empirics somehow works against them, suddenly it never happened in the first place. And we love the positive. Guys, you are not going to get yourself a nice thing said about you on the New York Times editorial page, or for that matter, in the news section, if you just simply push for liberty. I mean, look at Ron Paul. I mean, frankly, is there a person other than, I guess, they hate Sarah Palin more, I think because she's a female, but Ron Paul, look how he's just universally hated by these folks, even though Paul doesn't, you know, he doesn't make speeches attacking other folks. He doesn't call for revenge. He doesn't call for violence. He calls for peace. And yet look at the universal hatred that's directed towards him. Okay. And why? Because he pushes negative rights and negative solutions. And that is not good. He's not positive. We need to be positive. We need to break through and do something. All right. Again, if you have any comments or questions, please feel free to do it. I mean, either I put you to sleep, or, you know, I can't imagine I've mesmerized people. I'm not that good. So if you do have questions, Pam, thanks so much. Thanks so much for finding that stuff there. Okay. The easy way out. All right. What happened? Obama comes in the White House, says, we're going to spend our way out of this recession. Guys, great, man. Hey, nobody has to cut back on anything. Nobody has to worry about, hey, am I investing in the right? We're going to spend our way out of this recession. We're just that, it's like, hey, we're going to lose weight, baby. We're going to eat all the ice cream we can get. We're going to have ice cream every night. We are going to have rich desserts every night, and out of that we're going to lose weight. So what happened? You know, the government starts spending. I know Krugman's claiming we have been, he's called unprecedented austerity. I mean, this is hilarious, because what he's saying is the growth of government spending has dropped, and so there, which is, by the way, very different than saying government spending has dropped. And it's, but nonetheless, it's a deceptive term. But what happened? Well, you know, we had these, you know, $800 billion in stimulus, and I know if we'd only had $1.2 trillion, then we would have been out of this. But only $800 billion, so no, it just didn't work. And again, this is kind of one of those running arguments, isn't it, where you can, no matter what you spend, well, you should have spent more. Okay. But what happened? we have the stimulus, unemployment gets worse. Okay. And unemployment still is at 7%, and let's be really honest, people, it's probably significantly higher than that. And if they measured unemployment the way they did in 1932, it would be in the double digits. But nonetheless, what Keynesians said, we just haven't spent enough, all right? So, I mean, that I look at this and say, okay, so the cure for alcoholism is, you know, double your consumption of alcohol. I don't know. It's that kind of thinking. It's very frustrating. But you read these progressives, okay, and they say, all we got to do is just spend more money. And then they excoriate politicians who won't make the tough choices. You know, for what? For spending more, man. Dad, if you really wanted us to be rich in this family, you would double my allowance. You'd triple my allowance, quadruple it. Well, I'd spend as rich. Okay. Now you got to understand something. I've never ever read a satisfactory explanation from any of these guys. You know, Blinder guy, you know, from Princeton, Krugman from Princeton, God, you know, it's that, you know, they were the ones that gave us, I think it's either Carter Kruger was on the Princeton faculty, one of the two. In other words, my gosh, has any faculty done any more damage? I mean, this is a place that employs Peter Singer, you know, the eugenicist who believes that parents ought to be able to kill their children even when they're young if they don't like them anymore, and that's moral. And say, oh yeah, they got Cornell West, you know. So I mean, we're talking. This is Princeton University. If any of you are tied with Princeton, I don't mean to insult you. I'm just saying, modern Princeton faculty, you know, it seems to be kind of off the wall these days. But one thing I've never seen from these folks is a series of causalities that would enable these things to happen. They just, you know, it, for all the talk, by the way, of being scientific and, you know, the talk of empiricism, got to have empiricism, we've got to look at the results theory, they sure are resting upon a theory. And what they say is, you know, for example, if we're going to apply Keynesian theory, and we're going to apply more spending to get us out of the recession, and we don't get out of the recession, what's the answer? We didn't have enough spending. All right, Bowie, that's an a priori construct. Yeah, and by the way, they denounce Austrians for being a priori, but that's for another time. But nonetheless, it's the easy way out, right? And suspend. I mean, how popular is that, man? What if, you know, my dad had said, gosh, Bill, our family finances don't look good at all. We're in real trouble. Here, the problem is that you just need to quadruple spending. I'm going to quadruple your allowance. I mean, you know, is this a great country or what? I think we'd have gone broke faster, right? But that's just my opinion. All right. And the idea is that, when we add to government spending, okay, we hire more government workers, we can see this sort of thing, right? And the news, they always will concentrate on the people who now have so-and-so was unemployed for 13 months. Now he's got a job digging ditches, and he is so grateful to President Obama for for all the wonderful things he's done, because now he has a job, okay? Or people who get raises from minimum wage. Now, what they don't do is interview the people that have lost their jobs, the people in industries, the entrepreneurs who are unable to make a go of things because the government is pushing other things. Those folks are ignored. They fall through the cracks, okay? Again, it's part of the easy way out. You know, we're very much a media culture, and we like to see things in front of us. We are not very good at looking at those things that are invisible, or at least invisible to us, I would add. All right? And then there's intuition. Intuition over honest. Yeah, feels right. Okay, people have more money in their hand. They'll spend more. If they spend more, the producers will produce more. The economy will grow. All right, it's remarkably intuitive. And I mean, most people just believe it. As you know, all right. Yeah, by the way, but how progressive is this? Explain away Cuba. Very easy, Mike. Cuba has almost no illiteracy, and they have free medical care. And we all know what a great system they have because Michael Moore went down there, and he saw what fantastic health care they have. Of course, what he didn't say is, follow me, this is what the political elite get and everybody else gets. Oh, my gosh, you don't want to see hospitals elsewhere, places where people go to die. Part of it was that the progressives would explain it away simply by just not acknowledging something's existence. No matter how bad something was, you just, well, you look away. That probably can't be. Progressives, what they'll do is they will look at the supposed achievements and they say, you know, that, or they'll say, well, there's no poverty. It's like Dorothy Day. In an interview with Sojourner's magazine back in 1976 or so, talked about China. Might have been 79, but it was in the late 70s or mid or late 70s, and she was talking about how China was should be the pole star. Everything, because in China there's no want. Everybody has what they need. Well, this is the time when people are starving. And, you know, I'm sure that she knew about the Great Leap Forward, the mass starvation that occurred through there. But again, this is a very smart woman. This is not somebody who is, who was unaware. She wasn't just, you know, the little typical woolly-headed liberal. This is a very sharp person. And I know that there are a lot of Catholics, even libertarian Catholics or whatever, or anti-war Catholics who really like her. I'm not one of those people because, again, anybody who praises a regime that relies upon mass starvation and summary executions and mass imprisonment as a way to impose its will is not somebody that I really want to have any kind of relationship with or lay any praise on. It's a person like that. If a person sees mass murder as a legitimate political tool, then, you know, all bets are off. But that's just a, you know, thing there. Detroit, what they'll say, it's racism. They'll just blame it on racism. They'll say, well, the whites left the city after the riots of 1967, and that's what did it. And so they'll bring the racial element in it, and that explains all of everything. And one thing you have to understand about progressives, they really don't need a causality. They do not need a logical set of circumstances. They just say something and it's that way. You know, it doesn't question. It's one of the things about being on a college faculty is you really see that. You see people. And by the way, if you bring up something, I've seen this so many times happen, where you bring up something that might contradict their worldview and they just get silent. They just look at you and say they won't say anything. Or they'll walk away. I don't know. I mean, Raul Castro, I don't really care, you know, one way or the other. I mean, if Nixon, yeah, exactly right. If Nixon wanted to shake hands, I mean, that was a political thing. I mean, that was setting political relations with China. That's a whole different animal. I'm not against what Nixon did in 72. And for that matter, I'm not against Obama shaking hands with Raul Castro. I don't really care about that. You know, for that matter, you know, I wouldn't mind if we had, you know, diplomatic relations with North Korea. What is it they like to say? The United States doesn't recognize North Korea, and two Baptists in a liquor store do not recognize each other. But that's a political thing. That's a whole different thing. What I'm saying, morally speaking, though, I'm certainly not going to keep praise and consider, you know, I don't consider mass murderers to be great statesmen. I just don't. Unfortunately, nowadays, I'm not sure you can have political office anywhere without it. I don't know. That's getting a little far fetched. But again, getting back into it, if we just spend, we'll build up the economy. Okay, it's intuitive almost. And the other thing is, Keynesians don't differentiate between spending real demand, and then spending is demand. You know, you'll hear an economist say, well, the government needs to create demand. How? Put money in the hands of people and spend. Or Krugman actually said, well, actually, the helicopter is a really bad idea. Why? Because if you gave people money directly, they might save some of it or even pay down some of their debts. It's much superior. You get a much bigger jolt if the government spends, because the government won't save anything. The government will just spend everything. And that will create demand, okay? Whereas, as we all know, with Say's law basically says, what is your demand? Your demand is what you produce. You know, high-producing nations are high-consuming nations. Remember when we would hear, it's still sounding true, the United States has 25% of the world's population, 5% of the world's population consumes 25% of the world's resources. And I think, boy, that's a really neat trick. I mean, it's always presented in a pejorative manner, isn't it? The idea of, oh, well, look at that. They're just taking more than their fair share. The question is, how is it the United States can do that? The United States can do that because it was producing 25% of the world's goods and services, all right? So that was always left out. But, all right, then there's science. Oh, my gosh, you know, and mathematics, science and academic, wow. All right, and think about this. We can have explained economy as Y is equal to C plus I plus G plus X plus minus, plus X minus M. All right, wow, we've got the whole thing. In fact, you know, guys, the very first class I had in grad school was macro, and we would put that into reduced form. Y is equal to C0 plus C plus I0 plus, you know, in other words, the intercept of that, I0 plus I plus G0 plus I. So then now you start differentiating, you start doing calculus, and you spin. And my gosh, and then we had something with the automatic stabilizer that if you fell within a certain range using, that you would have the shocks would always return to equilibrium, but if not, you would have explosive thing, you know, but it was just crazy. But nonetheless, progressives love to appeal to science. That science has the answers. And by the way, that, you know, and I make this point, they appeal to genetic, you know, science and economics is like they appeal to genetic science and, you know, use that to promote racial segregation and eugenics, okay? It's not a cheap shot. I mean, you know, they appeal to science with that. Hey, we're not being racist, we're being scientific. You know, we're not saying anything, this is just a science. And so we can, you know, we can reduce the economy, make it, you know, mathematical. You know, I remember there was this fellow who used to write letters to the Chattanooga Times when I lived there, and he was all mad because of certain Reagan policy, because Reagan defense policies, were going to force the Soviet Union to computerize their entire economy and thus become strong, and then they'll end up becoming stronger because they're being forced to computerize their economy. Of course, and I'm thinking, wait a second, if computerizing their economy would make them stronger, why wouldn't they do it anyway? But this man was a true progressive, and he was unable to logically follow thinking very well. But nonetheless, there's this appeal to science, all right, and the greatness of science and C plus I plus G, all right. You know, and Mises himself argued that. He said, look, he said, because we insist on a priori, we do not insist on the scientific method of statistics and using, you know, of empiricism, of empirical analysis, or what Milton Friedman described as positive economics, that therefore we're dismissed as pushing metaphysics, okay? Because in the Austrian view, you begin with a set of premises that are observable and that everybody would hold to be true, and you build up from there. Okay, and Mises began with human action, right? That human beings act, and therefore we can draw a number of conclusions from that and make a number of applications. If you read the first section of Murray Rothbard's Mad Economy and the State, he does a beautiful job, and I mean a beautiful job, of putting that together. And rationalism versus empiricism. Okay, modern progressive economists will say they're empiricists. So Krugman himself will say, look, hey, we know that Keynes is right. Why? Because we Keynesians have been making the right predictions. And what he's saying is, look, we said we're in a liquidity trap, that all this monetary growth would not increase inflation. And the Austrians have all been predicting hyperinflation. And so they're obviously totally wrong. And I've had people, you know, say that to me. Well, how come we haven't had hyperinflation? Well, you know, we've had bubbles. I mean, we've got another bubble right now, stock market. And the Austrians would also tell you that you continue to apply, you know, new bursts of money, that you're over time, that on the margin you're going to get diminishing marginal returns to that, which has been happening. But nonetheless, that they'll see themselves as empiricists. You know, but for that matter, I think the Austrian theory is predicting pretty well too. And I think we could turn right around and say, you know, that we Austrians have been correct. All right. So in other words, I don't think the Keynesians can use that argument against us. We're dismissed as rationalists, but yet, I mean, think about it. Keynesian foundations are a priori, right? I mean, what is it that Keynes do? Since Keynes says, if we do this, this, or don't do this, this, and this, this is going to happen. All right, this equilibrium of high unemployment is done with an a priori argument. All right, and it's saying this, you know, and of course, that if we don't know, or what they like to say, of course, ours is a special case. It's a liquidity trap, okay? It's a special case in the economy, therefore, the other rules do not apply. Very interesting, okay? Which rules don't apply? The law of opportunity costs? Okay. So we can, and Krugman basically wants us to believe that. Hey, we don't have to worry about opportunity costs. We're in a liquidity trap. You know, who knows? All right. But I like to point out something. Hey, why is it that other recessions ended without all this massive intervention? Why didn't they? And by the way, and I'm talking about also where interest rates fell. I'm talking about situations in which you had financial crises. Why didn't the economy go permanently in the toilet then? Well, there's just no, you know, it's just ignored. Which is very typical how they do things. And then there's the progressive heroes. Okay, let's think about this, folks. Who are the two most celebrated people from the 30s? FDR and John Maynard Keynes. I guess a distant third would be Winston Churchill, right? What was it? Okay, it was FDR turned it into, took a depression, made it the Great Depression. And whereas Keynes offers a cure that neither diagnoses the problem or offers a real solution, and yet if you look back in the 20th century, they're the two biggest heroes. I think that, again, that is something that we look at and we kind of, that progressives are going to, make a big deal out of their heroes. And they don't have to be doing a very good thing. They can be doing a lot of damage, but it doesn't matter. If they're doing what progressives do, especially if they denounce markets and if they push positive freedoms, then they're going to be heroes. All right. What about accountability? We've got to understand something, that modern progressivism lacks accountability. One of the areas that I've done a lot of writing, maybe some of you are aware of some things I've done in the area of the courts and prosecutorial and police misconduct. I haven't done much in the last year, and that's because my life has taken a very, very different turn personally and been very, very busy to the point where other things have been crowding it out. But nonetheless, over the years, I've written a lot about that. And one of the things that I have looked at time and time again has been the lack of accountability in, in these offices and for people in these offices. And I ask myself, what's one of the reasons? Well, if you look at these, for the most part, this is what progressives believe, that people in these positions somehow were superior intellectually, morally. They did not need accountability because their own greatness would be accountability itself. That they would, they simply would not be the type of people that would abuse their powers. That they were a higher species of human. That's one thing I can think of. And so, so unfortunately, there is that lack of accountability in economics. Man, there's a huge lack of it. I mean, if Paul Krugman really were held accountable for all the stupid stuff he said, the man would, he would not be making $100,000 a speech. He would not be a multimillionaire. You know, he's always complaining about how other people are getting rich. Well, I say, physician, heal thyself. If you want income equality, begin with yourself, sir. You know, let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me. And, let there be equality on earth and let it begin with me. Go out and give away your income in massive amounts, sir. And, but I'm not so sure he's willing to do that. But nonetheless, he believes that you and I should be doing that instead. Well, what to do? All right. And this is, I think, can we level the playing field? And in conclusion, can we level that playing field? I believe yes. It takes perseverance. And I believe that we do not compromise our theoretical basis. You know, in politics, you do compromise. I mean, that's what I said before. If Barack Obama wants to shake Raul Castro's hand, if we want to have normalized relations with Cuba, great. Okay. That's political compromise. You realize you cannot solve everybody's problem. You cannot make other people into something. But in economics, okay, I believe that we do not compromise our theoretical basis, okay? Hayek did compromise. And, certainly Rothbard called his hand on it a lot. Rothbard and Hayek were not the best of friends. But Mises did not compromise. Rothbard didn't compromise. As a result, the stuff that they did, I think, was very, very good. I think that their writings are powerful. I think they're meaningful. And I still believe that that's the best way to do it. We're not, we really do believe, yes, that if, I'm out of work and the government gives me some money, yeah, it's made me individually better off. Is it good for the economy? No, it's not good for the economy. It's good for me, but at the expense of other people, all right? And the other thing is with Austrian economics, no matter what, it's never been discredited, ignored. I believe we don't have to be ashamed of the theories, whatever the implication. I believe that you tell the truth. You let the truth fall where it may. And You can't make the New York Times like you. You can't make other college professors like you. Or certainly can't make the politicians like you. But what you can do is tell the truth. Telling the truth, I believe, is a good thing. And, and Rothbard, I believe, was one person who did tell the truth. And on, the economy and in a situation like, what does he say? The one thing the government can do positively, it can drastically lower its relative role in the economy, slashing its own expenditures and taxes, particularly taxes that interfere with saving and investment. Reducing its tax spending level will automatically shift the societal saving investment consumption ratio in favor of saving and investment, thus greatly lowering the time required for returning to a prosperous economy. Okay? There's nothing wrong in saying that. I really do believe that. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're right, and it's not mentioned in the textbook. I will say this, Mike. I teach the MBA economics course, and the vast majority of comments that I get from students are, I am so glad to have been introduced to Austrian economics. I do get that. Let me see, there's an email I got just recently. I'm going to find it real quickly. This is one MBA student who said, I would like to thank you for the class and the great insights you provided. I truly enjoyed the material, the chats, and the knowledge I've gained from your course. That's exactly why I'm studying an MBA, to learn new things. I will never look at the world of economics in the same way as I did before taking Econ 511, Go Austrians. Okay, and actually I did use the Alcha Noun text, but point is that, he's one of many. The students really like it. They want to know, why haven't I been taught this before? It may be the best we can do right now. It's like the Mises Institute. My gosh, I mean, look what how the Mises Institute has just opened up so many avenues. All right, this is a good thing. All right, I believe this really is a good thing. And so I guess my last word is that, that I don't think we should tire of doing the right thing. All right. And again, Mike, I would agree. I mean, I know that, and I'm sure you do a good job, and I appreciate you bringing it in. And that, yeah, it's frustrating, especially when you have to do the Keynesian stuff and the AP exam does that. But nonetheless, if you can, anytime you get the truth in there, that's always a good thing. All right. That's where I would like to end it for me. If you have any other questions or comments, I'd love to hear them now. I'm in a singing ensemble, and we will have rehearsal begins in 9 minutes. And I've already told the director that I will be late, that I had this done. But nonetheless, so he's expecting me to be late. But I would like to, if you have questions or comments, this is the time to do it. And I appreciate your showing up and participating. And especially want to thank, of course, I want to thank Cam. I want to thank Danny for putting things together, making it a lot easier for me. I mean, I imagine that it can be frustrating working with someone who's not the best in technology like me. But these folks have really done some awfully good work. So I really thank both of you. All right. Any questions or any comments before I check out? And Merry Christmas to all of you. Absolutely. Wish me a Merry Christmas as I grade exams. Yes, yes, yes. I have great exams. And thank you very, very much. I really appreciate your showing up. And you guys take care. Have a good I do not, Russ. Wow. I did not realize that. I wish maybe I should have realized that. But, hey, guys, do I rest my case? Russ, rest my case, ladies and gentlemen. All right. I hope he is. We've discredited the sucker, by George. We've discredited the old boy, but there will always be people who are going to believe nonsense. I mean, people who believe nonsense from the beginning of time, we're not going to end it now. But thank you very much, and you guys have a really, really, really good Christmas, have a lot of fun, and maybe we can do this again sometime. And thank you, Danny, and thank you, Pam. Take care.